The French. Chapter 1. Universality of Christianity. Universality is one of the essential characteristics of Christianity. It is not so with human religions. They are adapted to a certain people, and to the degree of cultivation they have attained, they keep these nations stationary, or if by any extraordinary circumstance the people attain a fuller growth, their religion is left behind, and by that means becomes useless to them. There has been an Egyptian, a Grecian, a Latin, and even a Jewish religion. Christianity is the only religion of mankind. Its starting point in man is sin, and this is a characteristic not peculiar to any one race, but is the heritage of every human being. Hence the gospel, as satisfying the universal and most elevated wants of our nature, is received as coming from God by the most barbarous and by the most civilized nations. It does not, like the religions of antiquity, deify national peculiarities, but it does not destroy them as modern cosmopolitanism would do. It does better. It sanctifies, ennobles, and raises them to a holy unity by the new and living principle it communicates to them. The introduction of Christianity into the world has wrought a great revolution in history. Until then, there had only been a history of nations. Now there is a history of mankind, and the idea of a universal education of the human race, accomplished by Jesus Christ, has become the historian's compass, the clue to history, and the hope of the nations. But Christianity exerts its influence not only on all nations, but also on every period of their history. At the moment of its appearance, the world was like a torch about to become extinct, and Christianity rekindled it with fire from heaven. Subsequently, the barbarian tribes, having rushed upon the Roman Empire, had shattered and confounded everything, and Christianity, stemming that desolating torrent with the cross, subdued by it the savage children of the north, and gave society a new form. Yet an element of corruption already lay hid in the religion carried by courageous missionaries to those barbarous tribes. Their faith came from Rome almost as much as from the Bible. This element soon gathered strength. Man everywhere substituted himself for God, the essential characteristic of the Romish Church, and a renovation of religion became necessary. This Christianity accomplished at the epoch of which we are treating. The history of the Reformation in the countries that we have hitherto surveyed has shown us the new doctrine rejecting the extravagances of enthusiasts and of the new prophets. But in the country towards which we now turn our attention, infidelity is the show which it has to encounter. Nowhere had bolder protests been made against the superstitions and abuses of the Church. Nowhere had there been a more striking development of a certain love of learning, independent of Christianity, which often ends in irreligion. France carried in her bosom two reformations at the same time, the one of man, the other of God. Two nations were in her womb, and two manner of people were to be separated from her bowels. In France, the Reformation had to combat not only with infidelity as well as superstition, but there was a third antagonist which it had not yet encountered, at least in such force, among the people of German origin. This was immorality. The scandals in the Church were very great. Debauchery sat on the throne of Francis I and Catherine de Medicis, and the austere virtues of the reformers irritated these Sardanapaluses. Everywhere, no doubt, but especially in France, the Reformation was of necessity not only doctrinal and ecclesiastical, but moral also. Those violent enemies which the Reformation encountered simultaneously in France gave it a character altogether peculiar. Nowhere did it so often dwell in dungeons, or so much resemble primitive Christianity in faith, in charity, and in the number of its martyrs. If, in the countries of which we have hitherto spoken, the Reformation was more glorious by its triumphs, in that which is now to engage our attention, it was still more so by its defeats. If elsewhere it could point to thrones and sovereign councils, here it might point to scaffolds and hillside meetings. Whoever knows what constitutes the true glory of Christianity upon earth, and the features that assimilate it to its head, will study with a livelier feeling of respect and love the often blood-stained history that we now proceed to relate. The majority of the men who have afterwards glittered on the stage of the world were born in the provinces where their minds first began to expand. Paris is a tree that presents many flowers and fruits to the eye, but whose roots spread far and wide into the bosom of the earth, to draw from thence the nutritious juices which they transform. The Reformation also followed this law. The Alps, which beheld bold and Christian men spring up in every canton and almost in every valley of Switzerland, were destined in France also to cover with their lengthened shadows the infancy of some of the first reformers. For ages they had guarded the treasure more or less pure in their high valleys, among the inhabitants of the Piedmontese districts of Luzerne, Angrone, and La Peyrouse. The truth, which Rome could not reach there, had spread from these valleys to the other side of these mountains, and along their base to Provence and Dauphiny. The year after the accession of Charles VIII, son of Louis XI, a sickly and timid child, Innocent VIII had assumed the pontifical tiara, 1484. He had 7 or 8 sons by different mothers, and hence, according to an epigram of the times, Rome unanimously saluted him with the name of father. There was at that time on all the slopes of the Dauphinese Alps, and along the banks of the Durance, a new growth of the old Waldensian opinions. The roots, says an old chronicler, were continually putting forth new shoots in every direction. Bold men called the Roman Church the Church of Devils, and maintained that it was as profitable to pray in a stable as in a church. The priests, the bishops, and the Roman legates uttered a cry of alarm, and on the 5th calends of May, April 27th, 1487, Innocent VIII, the father of the Romans, issued a bull against these humble Christians. "To arms," said the pontiff, "and trample these heretics underfoot as venomous serpents." At the approach of the legate, followed by an army of 18,000 men and a number of volunteers, who wished to share the spoils of the Waldenses, the latter abandoned their houses and took refuge in the mountains, caverns, and clefts of the rocks, as the birds flee for shelter when the storm begins to lower. Not a valley, nor a wood, nor a rock escaped their persecutors. Everywhere in this part of the Alps, and particularly on the Italian side, these poor disciples of Christ were hunted down like beasts of prey. At last the Pope's satellites were worn out. Their strength was exhausted. Their feet could no longer scale the steep retreats of the heretics, and their arms refused to strike. In these Alpine districts, then disturbed by Romish fanaticism, 3 leagues from the ancient town of Gap, in the direction of Grenoble, not far from the flowery turf that clothes the tableland of Bayard's Mountain, at the foot of the Aiguille and near the Pass of Glaze, towards the place where the Buisson takes its rise, stood and still stands a group of houses, half hidden by the surrounding trees, and which bears the name of Farol, or, in the dialect of the country, Faro. On an extensive terrace raised above the neighboring cottages might be seen a house of that class which is denominated gentilhomier, a manor house. It was surrounded by an orchard which led to the village. Here, in these days of trouble, dwelt a noble family of established piety, known by the name of Farol. In 1489, the very year in which the papacy was employing its severest measures in Dauphiny, was born in this modest mansion a son who received the name of William. 3 brothers, Daniel, Walter, and Claude, and 1 sister, grew up with William, and shared his sports on the banks of the Buisson and at the foot of the Bayard. There William's childhood and early youth were passed. His parents were among the most devoted servants of the papacy. "My father and mother believed everything," he tells us himself, "and accordingly they brought up their children in all the observances of Romish devotion." God had bestowed rare qualities on William Farol, such as were fitted to give him a great ascendancy over his fellows. Possessing a penetrating mind and lively imagination, sincere and upright, having a greatness of soul that never allowed him, at whatever risk, to betray the convictions of his heart, he was remarkable also for ardor, fire, indomitable courage, and daring, which never shrunk from any obstacle. But at the same time, he had all the defects allied to these qualities, and his parents were often compelled to check his impetuosity. William threw himself with his whole soul into the superstitious habits of his credulous family. "I am horror-struck," said he, "when I consider the hours, the prayers, and the divine honors, which I myself have offered and caused others to offer to the cross and other such things." 4 leagues to the south of Gap, near Talad, in a hill that rises above the impetuous stream of the Durance, was a place in great repute, named St. Croix, the Holy Cross. William was only 7 or 8 years old when his father and mother resolved to take him thither on a pilgrimage. "The cross in that place," they told him, "is made of the very wood on which Christ was crucified." The family began their journey, and at last reached the highly venerated cross, before which they all fell prostrate. After gazing for a time on the sacred wood and the copper of the cross, the latter being made, as the priest told them, of the basin in which Christ washed his apostles' feet, the pilgrims turn their eyes to a small crucifix attached to the cross. "When the devils send us hail and thunder," continued the priest, "this crucifix moves about so violently that it seems to get loose from the cross, as if desirous of running at the devil, and it continues throwing out sparks of fire against the storm. If it were not for this, nothing would be left upon earth." The pious pilgrims were deeply moved by the account of these wonderful prodigies. "No one," continued the priest, "sees or knows aught of these things except myself and this man." The pilgrims turned their heads and saw a strange-looking person standing near them. "It was frightful to look at him," said Farrell. "White scales covered the pupils of his eyes. Whether they were there in reality, or Satan only made them appear so. This extraordinary man, whom the incredulous denominated the priest's wizard, on being appealed to by the latter, immediately replied that the prodigy was true. A new episode completed the picture by mingling a suspicion of criminal disorders with these superstitions. There came up a young woman, intent on other devotion than that of the cross, carrying her infant wrapped in a cloth. Then the priest went up, took hold of the woman and child, and led them into the chapel. I may safely assert that never did dancer take a woman and lead her out more lovingly than he did. But such was our blindness, that neither their looks nor their gestures, even when they had behaved in an unseemly manner before us, appeared otherwise than good and holy. It was clear that the woman and my gallant of a priest understood the miracle thoroughly, and made it a cover to their intercourse. Such a faithful picture of religion and morals in France at the commencement of the Reformation. Morality and belief were alike poisoned, and both required a powerful renovation. The greater the value attached to external works, the farther men were removed from sanctification of heart. Dead ordinances had been everywhere substituted for a Christian life, and a strange but not unnatural union had taken place between the most scandalous debauchery and the most superstitious devotion. Theft had been committed before the altar, seduction practiced in the confessional, poison mingled with the consecrated elements, adultery perpetrated at the foot of the cross. Superstition, by destroying belief, had destroyed morality. There were, however, numerous exceptions in the Christianity of the Middle Ages. Even a superstitious faith might be sincere, and of this William Farrell is an example. The same zeal that afterwards urged him to travel to so many different places to spread the knowledge of Jesus Christ was at this time attracting him wherever the church exhibited a miracle or claimed any adoration. Dauphiny had its seven wonders, which long possessed the power of striking the imagination of the people. But the beauties of nature that surrounded him had also their influence in raising his soul to the Creator. The magnificent chain of the Alps, those summits covered with eternal snow, those vast rocks, here rearing their sharp peaks to heaven, there stretching their immense and jagged ridges high above the clouds, as if an island was suspended in the air. All these wonders of creation, which were at this time elevating the soul of Ulrich Zwingli and the Tockenburg, were appealing also in mute but powerful language to the heart of William Farrell among the mountains of Dauphiny. He thirsted for life, for knowledge, and for light. He aspired to be something great. He asked permission to study. This was a great blow to his father, who thought that a young noble ought to know nothing beyond his rosary and his sword. At this time fame was trumpeting the prowess of a young countryman of William Farrell's, a Dauphinese like himself, named Du Terrail, but better known as Bayard, who at the Battle of the Tarn, on the other side of the Alps, had just given a signal display of courage. Such sons, it was observed, are like arrows in the hand of a strong man. Blessed is the man that hath his quiver full of them. Accordingly, Farrell's father opposed the taste which William manifested for learning. But the young man was not to be shaken. God destined him for nobler conquests than those of Bayard. He persevered in his entreaties, and the old gentleman gave way at last. Farrell immediately applied to study with surprising ardor. The masters whom he found in Dauphiny were of little help to him, and he had to contend with bad methods and the incapability of his teachers. These difficulties excited instead of discouraging him, and he soon surmounted these obstacles. His brothers followed his example. Daniel afterwards entered on the career of politics, and was employed in important negotiations concerning religion. Walter gained the entire confidence of the Count of Fürstenberg. Farrell, eager in the pursuit of knowledge, having learned all that could be acquired in his province, turned his eyes elsewhere. The renown of the University of Paris had long filled the Christian world. He desired to see This mother of all learning, this true lamp of the church which never knew eclipse, that clear and polished mirror of the faith, dimmed by no cloud, and spotted by no touch. He obtained the permission of his parents, and set out for the capital of France.